playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Back from the holidays, and my thanks to Fiona Kelly for minding the shop. So what's been happening? It already looks like we're shaping up for a lively political season. Brainstorming sessions, think-ins, less than 5 weeks to go to the October budget, and politicians limbering up for the new term and the next row. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar's letter to Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin asking to extend the confidence and supply agreement already fanning the flames and upping the ante for a general election. A topic discussed on The Gathering yesterday by journalists Mick Clifford and Katie Hannan and politicians Dara O'Brien and Paddy Smith.
It's just a funny war, basically.
It is.
The two parties can get their ducks in a row and see how exactly to ultimately bring about an election in such a way that the other crowd will get blamed for doing exactly. So.
And who's actually initiating that? But who initiates the media's danced to his tune.
Absolutely, there's an element to that.
He's with a Top Gun yesterday.
Why is Micheál Martin afraid to talk? But why is Micheál Martin afraid to sit down?
He met him in Killarney in July.
And why is he afraid to negotiate another conference?
I'll deal with that question. In July, they sat down for over an hour in Killarney. They discussed progress and it was agreed in July that they would meet again in September. So then what does Leo decide to do? It is September now, 2 days before we enter budget negotiations, a four-page letter, which is like a press release, and tweets it out there. He knows they were meeting.
Katie, I just want to come back to you.
It's pathetic, really.
I know, did you hear John McGuinness on this programme yesterday, the Fianna Fáil TD? Now, he's generally out of step with whoever is in charge of the party.
Particularly if the person in charge of the party is Micheál Martin.
Well, I think
he's had a go at others too.
But he was making the point that Fianna Fáil really shouldn't be going on with this, because this confidence and supply agreement, as it's called, it was done with the view to improving the situation of the people, solving problems. It hasn't done, and as he put it, Fianna Fáil has just been rolling over since.
Well, I mean, and John McGuinness will well know that there is a constituency out there among Fianna Fáil members who feel there is just so much of this they can take, and there is just so much of the propping up of this government that they can take the blame for, basically, on the ground. And he will know that he's obviously speaking to that constituency and he is stirring it up, which is what John McGuinness does very well. But I mean, he's to agree, I think, a very crucial move by Micheál Martin, I wonder, was it discussed at the July meeting with Leo Varadkar, was when he announced that they would not be supporting any motion of no confidence in the housing minister. Now, that and the run-up, if we'll recall, the run-up to the summer break, there was a lot of power in Sinn Féin's hands at that stage, that would they or wouldn't they put down this motion, and would Fianna Fáil, in all conscience, after everything they had said in relation to housing and the performance of the government, could they possibly support the government and not back that motion? And by taking that off the table, one of the first acts of the new season, that definitely dampened down any sense that we were on the precipice of any snap election.
And after all the controversies that have swamped the Garda force, the new commissioner finally took up office. Seasoned tribunal watchers Mick Clifford and Katie Hannan were again on the case.
Michael Clifford, a new Garda commissioner, was sworn into office in the early hours of last Monday morning, and Drew Harris, what's your assessment of him so far and what he's been saying and doing?
Well, as Mao Zedong said about the French Revolution, it's way too early so far, Sean, to say what any assessment. No, I mean, it was interesting the way he was sworn in. It's obviously, you know, symbolic, it's PR, but it's grand. Just a couple of interesting things. First of all, his comment that he's not bringing anybody in, which is quite interesting, because, for instance, the transformation of the RUC into the PSNI, you saw a lot of departures on very generous terms in order to bring a new wave of people in to take care of that. He says he's not bringing anyone in. That's very interesting. Also, I mean, he mentioned, and I think this is crucial, and this word accountability. He did it in the context of the budget. He wants to make sure that it's accountable what they're spending. But right across the board, from district level up, accountability is what it's about. It's what can make the massive difference within the Gardaí. That, along with political will, I think is a result of all the ructions over the recent years. The political will is possibly there, allied to the fact that they now, the policing authority, have far greater powers. But again, one other thing, both the policing authority and GSOC, in terms of their resources and in terms of the legislation, they need far greater powers to increase accountability. But Drew Harris, the fact that he's talking about accountability straight away, you'd have to hope that shows that he's going to bring things in the right direction.
Katie?
Yeah, I mean, he clearly, from what we've seen so far, is very savvy in terms of optics and communication. That midnight swearing in, that the first act going around to the Garda stations side by side with the men and women on the coalface. And also, I think, in terms of the accountability, the fact that he faced that first press conference on his own. We are so used to seeing Garda commissioners flanked by small armies of brass on either side and behind. He came out on his own and said, you know, a lot of the criticisms that have been levelled against him were personal matters, and that he wanted to address them himself, and he wasn't going to be, you know, looking to one side or the other for an answer. So, good start, I would say. It's a shame that he has come into it with some criticism and some questions hanging over his head. But I think one of the other big issues for him is going to be how he manages his relationship with the Department of Justice, because what we learned down at the Disclosures Tribunal, what has emerged subsequently from that expert review that was put in place after the controversies in the department, this whole idea that there was a deep dysfunction with that relationship between senior Gardaí and senior officials within the Department of Justice. There was a sense that they were all in it together, they were all down in the trenches together, they were all fighting everyone else away. The buck stopped nowhere. That was the line out of the report. Nobody was keeping anyone to account. So that will be interesting.
RTE's Katie Hannan and Mick Clifford of the Irish Examiner. Well, for many music fans, the perfect end to the summer holidays is marked by a pilgrimage to the Electric Picnic at Stradbally in County Laois, where the acts are always brilliant and the crack is 90. However, if you were following Facebook earlier this week, videographer Ed Rice posted footage showing the carnage left behind after the party was over. As much as 10 kilo of waste per person, according to Friends of the Earth, shocking evidence of our throwaway culture. Well, Ed Rice was keen that the abandoned tents and gear should go to charity. He spoke with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday.
Well, Sean, I waited round actually for 7 hours because of the carnage that I saw last year in the fields. And last year was much wetter, so there was some mitigating circumstances there. But this year was 4 or 5 times the size of the devastation right across the place. And I took the time to walk every campsite, walk right around about 3 kilometres just to see. And it was the same scene regardless of campsites. Not just tents, but all the air mattresses, there were headphones, electronic equipment, everything you'd need for camping, the folding chairs, everything like that, just left set up as if a nuclear holocaust had happened. It was quite something to see.
And you, I think, Ed, you're something of a festival veteran. I mean, how many times have you been to Electric Picnic?
About 8 times or 9 times, right back to the very early days when it was just a one-day festival where we even had to wait for someone to open the gates to get in. But this year was appalling. I mean, it was the worst. I've been to festivals in Europe like Werchter and Roskilde and those, and they have this leave no trace policy. It doesn't always work, but at least there's an ethos there to try and take what you brought at a bare minimum. But even as a parent, and I don't want to sound preachy, but do you not look at your kids when they come home and go, where's all your stuff? You know, you went away with 500 quid worth of stuff and now you've nothing. I mean, this is meant to be a very boutique and a very eco-friendly festival, and it is advertised as such if you look at the website, but there's no truth to it. Absolutely none. The charities had no chance yesterday before the diggers came in to push all the stuff away.
Just describe what happened yesterday, because you've put stuff up on social media. I mean, it's a bit like there's moving equipment there that you would normally associate with a landfill site.
Yeah, it was exactly that. There were a few people walking around as charities, but the security is all brought in from Scotland, I think. They all had Scottish accents or something like that, and they are just concerned with making sure there's no one asleep in the tent so they can shovel everything into a heap. So, I mean, if you're walking around trying, like we were, to salvage what we can, you can't, because the security is saying, get out. You know, you got to go now. We're going to be clearing this. And you can see the yellow shovelers waiting on the sidelines to do it. So clearly the organisers know exactly what they're going to be doing. So they're just paying lip service to the whole eco side.
Videographer Ed Rice heard on Tuesday's Today programme. Every day now, it seems, there's a new controversy involving US President Donald Trump, whose visit here in November is expected to be greeted with mass protests. But at home, too, there's drama, with the leaking of extracts from Bob Woodward's new book, Fear, Trump in the White House. And then a day later, an anonymous op-ed article appeared in the New York Times, written by a senior official in the Trump administration. RTE's Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan told Gavin Jennings about the latest insider hatchet job.
Well, last night, Gavin, Donald Trump began with his usual attacks of the media. He pointed to the journalists in the crowd, calling them fake news, which of course prompted the usual boos from the crowd. Then after about 30, 40 minutes of speaking, he started specifically talking about the New York Times op-ed. He said it was horrible, and he questioned if it was subversion or treason. He said that nobody knows who the hell he or she is, and that the New York Times should publish the person's name for the sake of national security. Donald Trump said the author of the article article was a gutless coward and that unelected deep state operatives are a threat to democracy. He then went on to say that the media had claimed that he'd been screaming and ranting and raving and stomping around the White House when he read the article, but that this simply was not true. We can hear now some of what President Trump had to say at his rally in Montana last night.
Today's Democrat Party is held hostage by haters, absolute haters, left-wing haters, angry mobs, deep state radicals, and their fake news allies. Those people are the best. They're the best allies of them. I mean, you look at the Washington Post or the New York Times, I can never get a good story. I mean, you look at this horrible thing that took place today. It's really, is it subversion? Is it treason? It's a horrible thing.
Brian, is it any clearer who the identity of the anonymous writer is?
No, Gavin, all still a big mystery, and it's still the talk of Washington, everybody trying to work out who this mysterious writer is. The New York Times claiming that this person was a senior official in the Trump administration, and the article claims that staff are alarmed by President Trump's behavior and that there's a resistance movement within the administration. President Trump suggested that maybe it's a low-level person in the administration. Throughout the day yesterday, one by one, senior members of the Trump administration were issuing individual statements saying it wasn't them, and apparently Donald Trump was paying very close attention to those denials as they were coming in. Now, the New York Times reported last night that the White House has drawn up a list of 12 suspects who they think might be behind this article. The Republican Senator Rand Paul has suggested using lie detector tests to find out who wrote the article.
Brian O'Donovan reporting for yesterday's Morning Ireland. Over on the Tuberty Show, Ryan spoke with Dubliner Ross McDonough. For the past 6 years, Ross and his family have made their home in Los Angeles, and he told Ryan about a very disturbing email he got from the superintendent at his son's school, advising parents that they needed to have a candid conversation with their children to prepare them for what was described as an active shooter situation. Ross's son is only 5 years old.
My child, just as any child, thinks school is this beautiful, innocent place of learning. He's learning his colours, his sums, you know, you learn to read, you're learning Spanish. And I also have to teach him, oh, by the way, you could be shot dead tomorrow, so this is what you need to do.
You've got three kids, but it's your five-year-old we're focusing on today. And when you're told to have an age-appropriate conversation with a five-year-old about a potential classroom and school massacre, where do you begin?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I went through a range of emotions when I got this email. I was like, what am I supposed to say to a five-year-old? I mean, he has no concept of death or guns or anything like that. And I have to tell him, you need to hide, you need to run, you need to... I mean, the first thing was anger, that I have to teach my five-year-old this at all, and revulsion. But then quickly, it became fear, and it was like, oh, actually, I want my son to have the best possible chance of survival in a situation like this, so maybe I should prepare him, maybe I should tell him what he needs to do. So that's the question I faced with. And I have a three-year-old who's in pre-K, and it's the same thing for him, you know what I mean? He just started school, and I have to sort of prepare him for this type of thing over here.
So did you actually sit down with Esteban and have that conversation?
I didn't. I wrestled with it for a while, and I decided not to, because, again, I really don't want to destroy his illusion of what school is. Mm. But a few months later, just before they broke for summer, he comes home with this classwork, and he always shows me his classwork, and it's usually, you know, I colored in a picture of a tree or a bear today, and he comes home and he shows me this, and it was the four steps for a lockdown drill, and it was these innocent little drawings that you can imagine what a five-year-old would do, and it was put your hands on your head, listen, freeze, turn off the lights, close the blinds, and, you know, it just made my stomach churn, you know. At first I was angry that this was being taught without my consent. I'm like, you know, you shouldn't be teaching my kid this, but then I'm like, well, what are the teachers supposed to do? You know, they live in this reality, so they kind of have to prepare the kids for this, which is, it's just so sad.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show on Thursday. Well, what a magnificent day last Sunday in Croke Park. All-Ireland football final day, with the Dubs slaying Tyrone to lift the Sam Maguire Cup for the fourth time in a row. It was also a big day for RTE sports presenter Michael Lester. He hosted his last Sunday game programme after a distinguished career on radio and television spanning 40 years. He was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Monday.
Were there lows as well in the job? I mean, you had a few tricky moments to handle.
Yeah, tricky moments, but not necessarily lows, but definitely awkward moments. And I mean, the most obvious one was Joe Brawley and the comments he made about a colleague of ours on the air. And you're sitting there, and I mean, you're just going through the process of, as you do and as I do, of handling the programme and handling the event that's going on. The next thing, Brawley says, and you're kind of thinking, what? And actually,
it was mean and nasty and personalised. He apologised for it later.
Yeah, he did. But I mean, obviously, the place kind of went. If there was a funny side to it, and it was mildly funny, the producer of the Sunday game, and he's busy down in the truck doing his stuff. And there's this kind of, it's like a satellite link pause, you know, those things you see where there's a gap of about 3 or 4 seconds. And the next thing Noel says, what? What did he just say?
I mean, did you ever have to maybe intervene in any way where maybe even off camera, like, was there ever a dig thrown or anything like that?
No, there was. I know, no.
There might have been rumours to that effect.
Ah, no. God, no. That never happened. But definitely, there is no doubt, Sean, there have been times when I've had to threaten, if that's not too strong a word, one or two of them about their behaviour and all that kind of thing, you know. But I would only ever have done that simply to try and keep some kind of control of what was going on. Because for me, and my philosophy with the whole thing with them is, and it's not just the three fellas we're talking about, others as well, some of our hurling panellists and all that kind of thing. And I was always conscious of the fact that I knew this was good entertainment. I knew this is what people wanted to hear, that they wanted to be engaged and entertained, but I couldn't let it go too far.
Michael Lester, who's retiring shortly from RTE Sport. It's also the end of an era for the Lambert Puppet Theatre, the company which was set up 46 years ago by master puppeteer Eugene Lambert and his wife May. It's the final curtain and the beautiful building is to be sold. And like so many of you, I've shining memories of going there to see magical shows with my sons when they were small, sparring with Mr. Crow, shouting back at Godmother and O'Brien, and of course, singing along with Judge on the Safe Cross Code. Well, Morning Ireland's Louise Byrne got the inside story behind the closure from Liam Lambert, who took over the running of the theatre from his father 18 years ago.
The excitement of the children and the involvement of them in a show has to be seen to be believed.
Daddy!
Oh, yes!
Where's Granny?
Where's Granny,
boys and girls?
The children you can hear were recorded more than 40 years ago. The Lambert Puppet Theatre thrived, featuring characters like Judge and Mr. Crow from the iconic children's TV programme Wanderly Wagon.
Can't go to mind your own business!
I prefer to take tea in the clock than in the company of some people I could mention.
So this is the workshop here.
The Lambert's workshop has created puppets, careers and countless memories. But a decision has now been taken to sell the building. Eugene's son Liam took over the puppet theatre around 18 years ago.
It's extremely hard to be closing the theatre with all of its memories. I'm sure it's going to affect an awful lot of people. So the pressure of just keeping the whole thing going is quite enormous. It's been extremely difficult. Yeah.
Liam Lambert says the theatre hasn't recovered from the economic crash.
There's a very old saying in the theatre business, first into recession and last out. For those 10 years, we basically really were just managing to keep the doors open. So when the crash happened, right at the beginning, we were hit straight away. Our demographic for the theatre, being people with young children, were the first hit and hit hard. And 60% of our turnover would have been with school tours. And in the first year, that was hit at least cut in half. 3 years ago, there was an arson attack on the building and I lost over 300 puppets in that. That was an enormous blow. You know, you keep on going and you keep on going. But you do realise there's a point that you have to stop, health-wise as well.
Louise Byrne reporting for Wednesday's Morning Ireland. And while the building will be sold, it's hoped the Lambert Puppet Theatre can continue as a touring company. On Thursday, Russia came under fire at the UN Security Council as Scotland Yard investigators released the names and photographs of two men from the Russian military intelligence agency wanted for the Novichok nerve agent poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury last March. Well, the modus operandi of the KGB was also on the agenda when Marion Finucane spoke with Conor O'Cleary and his wife Jana last Saturday. They met in Moscow and married just before the fall of the Soviet Union, when the policies of perestroika and glasnost allowed the Russian people to see how the experiment launched by Lenin had failed. Conor was bureau chief for the Irish Times in Moscow at the time.
Western journalists in Moscow were very much part of a community that was monitored by the authorities and with very little contact with Soviet citizens.
Right.
We had an interpreter supplied by the foreign ministry who reported to the KGB. We had a driver, the same thing. We had special shops. We lived in compounds which were guarded by police. Everything was done to ensure that we didn't speak to anybody else except ourselves.
Yes.
It soon became clear that Conor needed someone to teach him Russian. Jana was that PhD student who wanted to practice her English.
So where did the KGB come into it?
KGB came into it maybe half a year into us knowing each other or having lessons and then also interacting on this most amazing period in the Russian-Soviet history when everything opened up. And I myself had a chance to learn so much about my own country. I was once summoned to the head of postgraduate course. A secretary said to me, "Here is a young man who wants to see you." And he said, "I'm KGB, I would like to talk to you, can we go for a walk?" And he basically started asking me, who do I know in the foreign community? And I said, "Of course, I live in the residence where we have quite a few foreigners, this and this. Do you know any journalists?" And I said, "Why don't you start from that then?" Because he knew that I was seen with Conor.
Jana was asked by the KGB man to report on conversations that we were having at dinner parties. And some of the people at the dinner parties, they would be very interested in, like Zan Smiley, who was the Daily Telegraph correspondent and the son of Smiley of John Le Carré books.
Indeed, right, yeah.
And Robert Cornwell, whose brother was John Le Carré. So we were very friendly with them, and the KGB guy wanted to know what we talked about. So Jana told me about this approach, and I thought, well, I can't write about this because it could cause enormous problems for Jana's family. And I was very aware that there were dangers in it for me because journalists in those times were quite often thrown out of the country. So I went to see Judith Devlin in the Irish embassy and I said, "Look, I don't want anything done about this. I just want it on the record." And then Jana was approached a second time and then a third time. And the third time was much more menacing. And they threatened her that they would stop her getting her dissertation.
Her PhD.
And they also were trying to tempt me because they knew I couldn't stay in Moscow. Because as a student, postgraduate student, yes, I had residence permit for those 3 years. They did say, "You cooperate with us, we allow you residence permit to stay in Moscow." And I said, "Listen, I have a family at home. I have a daughter. My husband had died." I said, "I'm graduating and I'm going back home. And listen, there is no way I'm going to report to you on the person with whom I'm close."
Anyway, as it transpired, they didn't.
As transpired, they didn't. The minute we eventually got married, but they did transfer the file. When I moved back, after I finished presented my dissertation, I went back for a year to Siberia because we decided we needed time apart so that we would really think through. And when I arrived, a guy appeared at my university where I was teaching and said to me, "You know, can I talk to you?" And they passed on my file and I said to him, "Listen, I'm here, he's there. What do you want from me now?"
And then he asked Jana to teach him some English.
Conor and Jana O'Cleary heard on the Marion Finucane show. And Conor's latest book about Jana's family and their life in Siberia is called The Shoemaker and His Daughter. Listeners to Liveline and The Mooney Show will remember Maisie Flood. She was a wonderful Dublin character, great friends with Joe Duffy and Derek Mooney, and a regular at Funny Friday gatherings. Maisie was a diehard Liverpool football fan with a special place in her heart for Steven Gerrard, the player she called Stevie Wonder. Well, Maisie died last Saturday at the fine old age of 105, and Joe remembered her on Wednesday's Liveline.
Maisie Flood was on this programme many times over the years, but I think this is one of the last interviews with her. Rebecca Meehan, who was the series producer here on Liveline, and Annette Egan went out to the nursing home in Ballyfermot and spoke to Maisie Flood. And Maisie, as always, leading the conversation, led them into her favourite subject, which is Liverpool Football Club.
Stevie Wonder now, because I love Stevie. Well, my Stevie Wonder is Stevie Gerrard, you see, because he's a fantastic player. This is the most wonderful team in the world, and for you to stand up when the team is coming out and you say, start singing "You Never Walk Alone," which 40,000 I've sang with, it's unreal.
When Brenda Donoghue worked on Mooney Tunes, she was Maisie's official minder, and she recalled the great adventures they shared.
I think the first time I came across her, she would have been about 96. And she had gone to a panto in Liberty Hall with her group, the Wednesday Club. And she sang "You'll Never Walk Alone." Now, the version you played there, her voice is a bit stronger.
Well, that was from her difficult second album, Brenda. She was...
Yeah.
She was
But she was phenomenal. And yeah. I know in life, you and myself, we're lucky to meet incredible people. But she was somebody I would have kept in touch with. And she kept in touch with me, whether I liked it or not. There were a lot of phone calls. But we brought her over to Anfield, to her beloved Liverpool.
Brilliant.
I think she was 97 at the time. And we went over to Liverpool. She'd never been there before. She could analyse a game better than Eamon Dunphy, John Giles. She knew exactly strategy, two up front, three behind, whatever was going on. And before we went to the game, we went, and John Aldridge, of course, famous Liverpool player, he was doing a question and answer session with all these Liverpool fans. And she got up and she took the mic and she sang. I'm not kidding you, there were people crying, like the emotion that they felt when she sang. And then we went to the match and we walked up to the stadium and I was going, oh God, she's 97. I hope the tickets are like up
too high up.
They were right up at the back.
Okay.
She literally sprung up there, the excitement, waving at everybody, shaking their hands, telling them all how old she was. And she got up there and did her beloved Stevie Wonder, as she calls him, or Stevie Gerrard, didn't he score a goal?
Wow.
Oh, it was just amazing.
Remembering Maisie Flood, Brenda Donoghue heard on Liveline with Joe Duffy on Wednesday. Well, if you were in the National Concert Hall in Dublin this week, you would have been tripping over some of the world's leading scientists, including five Nobel laureates. They were at a conference organised by Trinity College to mark the 75th anniversary of the important series of lectures given by Austrian scientist Erwin Schrödinger. One of the speakers at the conference was Professor Linda Partridge, an expert on the future of ageing and diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. She spoke with RTE's science correspondent, Will Goodbody.
Professor Partridge, I suppose, what's the key to staying younger for longer? That's what everybody wants to know.
Well, the usual message of healthy lifestyle, I think. The World Health Organization is really pushing that at the moment, that if we want to stay healthy for longer, I think it's something like 1.3 billion people worldwide aren't taking enough exercise. That's extremely important. Quit smoking, of course. and try and eat a healthy diet and not too much of it.
You found that there are universal genes across different species that when manipulated can lead to increased lifespan. Tell us a bit about that.
That's one of the major discoveries about ageing, that it's a very flexible, malleable process. We all get old, but it's possible to actually change the end of life so that there's not so much disability and illness. So we've produced, several labs have produced long-lived mice that show a remarkably broad spectrum improvement in health during aging. So they've got less diabetes, their skin's better, their eyes are better, their bones are better, often with very simple lesions that you can target with drugs. So I think there's really a prospect of intervening in the aging process itself to try and prevent these horrible age-related diseases, the cancers, the neurodegenerative diseases, the cardiovascular disease.
Will Goodbody reporting for Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Later that day, Ray Darcy's guest was Cathy Ryan, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's 4 years ago when she was only 53. Today, Cathy's heading off to walk the Camino to raise funds and public awareness for people with dementia. And while she's excited about this latest adventure, she's also very nervous. She described the ways in which the disease is making inroads into her life.
I suppose in the afternoon I might be speaking to somebody where I would have done something in the morning, and the morning will just be a block of nothingness. I actually won't remember what I did. If too many things are coming at me, just complete stalling and how did I get here? What am I doing here? What do I need to do to continue from here? Things are moving along. Concentrating. It's all concentrating from when I get out of bed in the morning, whether it's in the shower and not remembering whether I use the shower gel, or even I find myself now putting large C's and S's on like shampoo and conditioner so that I know which is which. So it's concentrating on everything, or something silly can happen, or something a little bit more serious.
On the serious side, what has happened?
I've taken stuff off the grill without putting something on my hand, or a fish slice or a fork, or I just stopped myself recently taking a pan out of the oven without putting anything on my hands. So, yeah, it ranges from, as I say, silly that I learned to laugh. And
I'm interested to know, when you say that you lose a morning, have you quizzed people who were in your company on that morning? What I'm interested in, do you behave normally, although you can't? Do you know what I mean?
I hope I always behave normally.
No, but do you know what I'm saying? If you like, it scares you that you can't remember. Obviously, that's very scary. But do you wonder what you did and what you said and who you interacted with? And
for me, no, it's just it's gone.
It's gone, right.
It's then there's a bit of frustration, because no matter how hard I try to find something in my head that happened, I don't. So my first would be to go to my diary and see if something was in it. And if there's nothing written in that, then it's really, oh gosh. I try and stay in the moment. I try and stay today. Things are moving on for me. Things like falling downstairs if I don't concentrate, you know, getting into the car and I want to go the other side of Cashel, there's three roads in between. I can't picture those roads. So.
And you said the last time that your sensory, like taste and sound,
hearing,
all of
hearing,
that,
has
that
a real challenge. Yeah, it's all moving on. It's all, every day is harder to get through the day. It takes more work. It takes more planning. It takes more
energy and effort.
Energy and effort. And it's exhausting.
Yeah.
Really.
Cathy Ryan with Ray Darcy on Wednesday. How many times have you arrived off a flight at Dublin Airport, bleary-eyed, headed straight for the long-term car park, and had a complete blank about where you parked your car? Well, apparently this happens to about 4,000 people every year, and now airport officials are introducing a new app to solve the problem. Mary Wilson, a self-confessed offender, spoke with Paul O'Kane on Drive Time.
On average, about 11 customers a day in our long-term car parks are unable to find their cars when they return. That adds up to about 4,000 customers a year. And what typically tends to happen is the person arrives back from their holiday, they think they know where they parked their car, they spend, as you did, a period of time looking for their vehicle, and eventually then they kind of bite the bullet and decide to contact us so we can help them find their car. We have a team on site in our long-term car parks 24/7, so we have people in electric vehicles who'll zip around and help them find their car. And we can normally reunite them with their vehicle once they've contacted us. But what we've decided to do, we've always had a system in place where for the last 18 months, We have a very nice system on our Dublin Airport app where you can actually geotag your specific car parking place to make it really simple to find your car parking place. But not, we know that not everyone does that. Some people will take a photograph of the zone that they're parked in. But one of our staff, a chap called Brian Murphy, had a brilliant idea of putting little luggage tags in the bus stops at all of the long-term car parks. The luggage tag will tell you that you're in the red car park, the green or the blue, it's colour-coded, and you simply write the location of the car, so you write A7, and then you can see you're parked in A7.
Which is terrific, and it makes great sense, but of course that doesn't account for the, you know, those of us who arrive at the airport in a bit of a flap.
We had one specific customer who arrived and spent a period looking for his car. He then contacted our staff, and we can tell roughly where your car is, because once you tell us when you parked the car, we know how we manage the car parking spaces, so we can figure out where it is. But in this particular case, we couldn't find this gentleman's car. We looked high and low. He was becoming more and more stressed and agitated, as you would be. And eventually, along with him, we called the Gardaí, and he reported that the car had been stolen. And he then took a cab home, and he rang us very sheepishly the next morning to apologise for all of the fuss and confusion, because in actual fact he had been driving his wife's car.
Oh,
and he'd forgotten that he'd been driving his wife's car.
Yeah, that can happen too.
From Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Wednesday. The politics of the famine was discussed on Arena on Tuesday night when Sean Rock's guest was Stephen Ray, who stars in Lance Daly's latest film Black 47, which has just gone on general release.
Interesting then, if you think about Black 47 in those terms. I mean, it's a very, obviously, it's an Irish story, and an Irish story that maybe is that not that familiar to those who are not part of the Irish diaspora, outside of this country.
Oh, no, that's true.
How international a film can it be, do you think?
Well, Sean, 2 days ago, I'm looking, 8 million people died in the Yemen. Are dying of famine. And when we did this movie and showed this movie in Berlin, there was an Ethiopian journalist there who completely agreed with me when I said, you know, famine only occurs in colonized countries. So it's still happening. It happens wherever the hungry people don't control the distribution of the food. We seem to be callous about that. You know, I haven't done anything about the Yemen. And people here, I think, feel a certain kind of residual guilt about the fact that all of these people were let die on famine ships and, you know, the appalling world that was there. And as the character says, as the Lord says in this, the famine is helping me because I didn't want all these people living here, you know. And that's the callous attitude of the colonizer.
Stephen Ray there, heard on Tuesday night's Arena. A film, with us in it, presented by Carol Moran and Owen Sweeney, looks at the stories behind the movies that put Ireland on the map. On Wednesday night, they took a trip to Colm Tobin's home place of Enniscorthy in County Wexford to see how the town has embraced its association with the film Brooklyn. Cathy Keane runs the Brooklyn movie tour, and she remembers the buzz of the film shoot.
It was very much, who got a part? Did you get a part? I brought the children down. What did you wear? Don't wear that. So everybody was leading up saying that there was a chance for everybody in the town to be involved. It wasn't something that was being made here and all the outsiders were coming in to make it. Of course, the leading actors and actresses would have been from outside the town. But there was potential there for a lot of the locals to be involved. They gave employment to the people in the area. So everybody had a chance to be part of something that was going to, positive that was going to happen in the town of Enniscorthy, and that was huge.
So how important has Brooklyn been? Have you had people come here because they've seen the film?
Absolutely, and I can attest to that because with my little business that I have with the tourists, I have gotten emails and people have come to stay in this town for one night only just to visit where the movie was made. So unfortunately, we don't have a cinema in the town, but the council, in conjunction again with Lionsgate, secured a premiere night for us here in the town, and they put a makeshift cinema into the local hotel, one of them, the Riverside Park Hotel. And I went down and it was such a party atmosphere down there, and it was wonderful, and other people came along. So it was a fair distribution of the tickets. And on the night, everybody dressed up like a royal premiere. It was fun. Colm Tobin attended and some of the other actors and actresses from the movie. Saoirse Ronan, unfortunately, was otherwise committed. But
we didn't mind. When it was on and when it was over, it was one of those nights that if anybody stood up, you couldn't see the screen. It was comical. It was like, sit down, we want to see the screen. I just couldn't believe how good it was, and I was delighted. It was so brilliant. But the big thing about the night was those people sitting there were looking. It was nothing to do with the top stars. But there's Jim. I can see Sophia. No, no, she's over there to the left. No, no, where's you know, looking out for their friends. And that was it. Did you see Marge? She was the one. She closed the door there in that scene. So this movie was actually a movie about the local people of Enniscorthy, and Saoirse Ronan happened to be in it.
Cathy Keane heard on A Film With Us In It, presented by Carol Moran and Owen Sweeney on Wednesday night. Over on Second Captains, the star guest was Sharon Horgan, the multi-award-winning comedian, writer and producer with a string of TV comedy series to her name. She's also the sister of rugby legend Shane Horgan, so obviously Owen, Murph and Ken were keen to explore the highlights of her own sporting achievements.
So I had an accident when I was about 12. I dislocated my hip. I didn't realise that I dislocated it. It was just like, oh, that's a bit sore. And my mum took me to our GP and he was like, yep, that's growing pains. And I was like, great, see you later. Anyway, it wasn't getting better. And, you know, she took me to all sorts of places. Actually, I ended up seeing...
Sean Boylan.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, Herbalist extraordinaire. So, you know, and that didn't work. Herbs didn't fix my dislocated hip. So eventually we went into the hospital in Drogheda and they went, oh, your hip's severely dislocated. We're going to operate on it now. Have three steel pins put in, and I was in hospital for a few weeks. But when I came out, part of the sort of getting better, the physio of it was to, you know, start running again. And weirdly, when I came back, I was sort of better at running than I... Yeah, so I was convinced I was bionic. Oh. I was convinced that I was like Lee Majors, you know, I'd been rebuilt. A bionic woman, I suppose, is a better reference.
How far did this career take you, this new bionic leg?
It took me... I had no idea if I was any good or not, right? So we went to the Meath finals and I think my dad would have loved us all to be sports heroes. He came along to the Meath finals and, you know, when you were running, it was like long distance, like cross country or whatever. When you're running those sort of long distance races, you never know whether you've been sort of lapped or if you're miles ahead. You're just kind of running in a sort of fugue of pain. And I remember coming over the line and just being, oh, well, that was that. And like my dad running up and saying, you know, you came third. And I was like, what? Oh my God, I think I could have won that. I definitely didn't use all my energy at the end. If I'd known I was third, I literally could have come first. So at that point, I was like, right, well, I'm a runner. That's it. That's
so
it.
So you have all the natural ability in the world. Some focus issues, perhaps. You know, small, perhaps,
what?
You know, well, just on the mental side of things, you know.
Murph, it's called being in the zone. It's whatever runner dreams of.
I was in the zone.
Sharon Horgan. I'll leave you now with a song from Usheen Walsh Pilo, his brother Ferdia, and soprano Aoife Moore. They played live on Monday night's arena. Gramag of Asfergoluther, Tasulam Gurwanchev Saltasaglor, Agus Gameshev Lum Takana Makena, and Tachtan Shahugin, Kajishin, Kajeshep Slan.
Oh dear, what to do now? Fall in the rut with your friends, stay home until it ends. Oh dear, oh dear.